Welcome to the Alex Kennedy Podcast, which is part of the Basketball News Podcast Network. This is episode number 24. We post new episodes every week, so make sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Today, I'm joined by a very special guest. She is one of my favorite writers. She writes amazing articles for The Ringer, and she has a book coming out on August 10th, 2021 that's available for pre-order now. The book is Giannis, The Improbable Rise of an NBA MVP. My guest is the great Mirin Fader. Mirin, thanks for joining me. How are you?
Oh my gosh, thank you for having me. I'm good. I'm alive. I'm surviving. I'm in COVID, but we're coming out of it. It's good to be here.
Absolutely. And congratulations on your first book. I have to say that. I'm so excited to read it. Everyone should definitely pre-order it right now. It's available for pre-order. Anyone that's read your long form articles and your in-depth pieces, I'm sure they were thinking it's only a matter of time until a book comes, because you're so good at getting new things out of players, anecdotes, amazing quotes, telling their story, their life story. And you do such a great job with the long form pieces that a book only made sense. Because this is your first book, I'm curious, can you walk me through your process from the research to the interviews to actually writing it and kind of what that entailed?
Yeah, well, first off, thank you so much for saying that. Like, seriously, you're so kind. I've been wanting to write a book forever. I was like on this from the beginning, and a lot of, you know, the book process starts with like trying to find a literary agent and trying to find, you know, somebody that believes in you. And then you also have to have an idea that is not only interesting, but can sell. So it felt like this giant mathematical equation that I had to somehow solve. And I just kept hearing like, oh, you're too young. Like, I like you, but you're a little young, or like, love the idea, it won't sell. So a lot of my early ideas just were not good enough. And I just kept trying and trying and trying. And finally I found an agent that believed in me, and I just kept pitching to him. And he was like, you know, I just don't think these ones are it, but like, you've got so many great stories out. I wonder if something will come out of a story. And the Giannis story dropped, where I went to Milwaukee to profile Giannis's youngest brother, Alex. And there was so much chemistry that day in their home between Giannis and Alex that I realized this is not just a story about Alex. This is really revealing parts about Giannis. And at that time in summer 2019, this was like right before he won his first MVP award, I felt like the only conversation around Giannis was his freakish athleticism and, you know, obviously the Greek freak and all that. But nobody ever really talked about him mentally. Nobody ever talked about the vulnerable sides, especially after having lost his dad. And so my story, I felt like, showed that vulnerable side. And so I thought, this is the book. Like, this has to be the book. It's got the human interest stuff. You know, we really only know that Giannis grew up poor and undocumented and had to sell trinkets by the street, but that's it. There's missing so much between impoverished teen and NBA MVP. And so I was like, what's missing is the connective tissue is storytelling. So that's how that first book started. And then I got the deal late 2019, went to Milwaukee right before Corona. Thank God the world shut down, and I had 1 year to do the book. So March 2020 to March, 2021. So 221 interviews later, we're done.
Wow.
So, yeah. It's a long-winded intro, but that's how it happened.
I love it. And I'm glad you're writing this book, because again, other writers, you know, they may not have went as deep, and there were so many elements of this that, you know, need to be uncovered and talked about. I feel like it's something that's straight out of a Disney movie. Like, it's not even just a rags to riches overcoming the obstacles story. It's a family story, a story about family. And it's a, I mean, we see not only when he was younger and, you know, selling trinkets with his family and everything there, but since he entered the NBA too, we've also seen that his main focus has been his family and supporting them, and they all live together. And it's just such a cool story. So I'm really glad that you're the one that's kind of doing it. I cannot wait to see, you know, different details that you uncover and different anecdotes and things like that. But I'm curious, your long form articles, as I said, you always do an amazing job with them, and you can tell you put in a ton of work into them. You know, how did writing this book differ from writing your typical long form pieces?
Yeah, you know, the first 2 days where I sat down to work on this, I was like, okay, what do I do? And, you know, because I have never written a book before. But then I thought, this is just like what you do. You report the hell out of it. You sink your teeth into it. You call all the other people that others deem unimportant. You get gems and anecdotes, and you grind away. And so I started looking at writing a book as like same language as long form, different dialect. You know, in a lot of my long form stories, there's ellipses that separate sections because we're trying to create cadence and keep the reader interested. Like, you know, you need to pause for emotional effect. Now imagine that on steroids.
Yeah.
We have 100,000 words. So it's like, how do you keep someone going? So, you know, I would say the biggest difference is like sustaining attention for longer periods of time. Like, you know, what anecdote absolutely needs to start this book so that this person will not put this book down? And also like supplying things that can make you interested in a story that is about one person, but about so many others. I think when I profile somebody, it's all about them. They're the main show. But in a book, you have characters. So, you know, Jason Kidd is a character. Bud is a character. His first coach in Greece was a character, and the mom is a character. And so you're like trying to draw out personalities because you're following not just the main character over, like I said, like 100,000 words.
You know, I mentioned this already, but the way that you're able to get new anecdotes and new information and get players to open up to you is really incredible. You know, you and Jeff Perlman are two of my favorite writers, and you're both excellent at that. I feel like, you know, there's people that spend their entire, every single day, they spend the entire season with these players. But then you and Jeff, you're both so good at uncovering new stories and new details. You know, you kind of touched on one reason why, and it's talking to everyone, you know, regardless of, some people may think, oh, I'm not going to talk to Ja Morant's high school principal. But when you featured it, you know, did a feature on him, you're talking to everyone. You're talking to old teammates. Obviously, that's part of it. But what else are some of your secrets? How are you able to get so much new information? I know that's a big part of it, but what are some, you know, how do you do it?
Yeah, well, thank you for that. I mean, the first thing is like, I need to read every single thing that is out there on the person I'm writing about, whether it's a book or a long form. And I know some writers don't do that because they're like, I don't want to get these other ideas in my head, or like I'm intimidated or blah, blah, blah. But I'm like, no, I need to know what the competition's doing because I want to separate myself. Because I kind of do, I used to be a basketball player, so I do view this competitively, you know? Yeah. So I have to like figure out like, all right, all of this has been asked, but this has never been asked. So I think the new questions come out of just like, being like doing your homework. Like, I know it sounds so obvious, but like, you know, being well-researched is so important. And the second thing is pushing for detail. So when somebody tells me that Giannis is hardworking, I'm like, okay, water's wet. You know, we know that, but like, what are the, you know, what's the earliest in the morning you've seen him be there? Oh, he's hard on himself. How? Can you give me the example of a drill where he was just beating himself up? It's like pressing and being relentless about details, and you're not satisfied with just, oh yeah, like he's a selfless guy. Like, you're pressing for story, you're pressing for narrative. And then I think to your point about talking to everybody, some of my best gems came from guys who were like the 15th man or like a training camp hopeful. Like, I had a great interview with Stephen Graham, who's now a coach with the Nuggets, a player development guy. And he was telling me about this drill where they just kept knocking Giannis over, like on his ass. And it was just, again, you would never think like, oh, Stephen Graham, like, do I need to interview him? You know, this isn't the Jabari Parkers of the team, but it was like, it was perfect because he told me about this drill. He thought he like broke Giannis's ribs or something, you know, because, you know, rookie Giannis was like so scrawny. And again, I was like, oh, this anecdote is gold, but I wouldn't have gotten it if I didn't, you know, put in the work and call everyone.
For sure. Fun fact, I went to the same middle school as Stephen Graham. So I haven't heard that name in a while, but you mentioned it. So I had to throw it out there. I think you can see in your articles too, though, you mentioned the little details and asking those follow-up questions. Like in your Andre Drummond piece, you talk about how he would kind of, you know, how hard he was on himself during drills and, you know, hitting himself and throwing chairs and things like that. So you can definitely see, you know, that really pays off when you ask those kind of questions, and you can see it in the articles. One thing with Giannis, I feel like a lot of fans don't realize some of the backstory, like, you know, that he was an illegal immigrant in Greece, so he couldn't play in the top clubs. I've talked to NBA scouts who compared the lowest pro division he was playing in to a YMCA league. So it makes his story even more improbable. Or the fact that, you know, he was discovered by a basketball coach who saw him running around, and, you know, he offered to find Giannis's parents' work if he joined the basketball team. You know, I think there's just so many things that maybe casual fans don't know about Giannis's story. What were some of your favorite anecdotes that you dug up while reporting this book? You've shared a few of them on Twitter, but I'm curious, what are some of your favorite ones?
Yeah, you know, I think some of my favorite anecdotes were actually the parts of the story that have been undercovered, like the racism he experienced. I really don't, because it has been framed as such a fairy tale story, as we talked about earlier, people don't realize that although Yanis was accepted by many people and there were many awesome Greeks that did help him out and give him food, there were also seriously racist people. They went to this place called Trikala, and all these fans were just saying the most racist things in the stands about him. And, you know, you look at that and all these people nowadays are just like, oh, Yanis, you're the best. But like they sweep that under the rug. And so you will see a lot of stuff about that. Some of the other anecdotes that I found truly heartwarming was what a good friend Yanis was. So one of his besties was actually Muslim, and they needed to go to the church that Yanis belonged to because that's where they gave food to kids that needed it. And for Yanis, who hadn't eaten all day, it sounded like a great thing. But the friend was like, I can't go. Like, I'm Muslim. They're going to like kick me out. And so Yanis was like, don't worry, my friend, like, we'll be okay. And so he brings him in there and he's like, look at my friend. He says this to the priest. Yanis says this to the priest. He's such a good Christian guy. Can he get some food? Great Christian, good guy, whatever. And the priest looked at the guy and he was like, okay. And Yanis was like, see, you gotta trust me. And so I just love those heartwarming anecdotes about what young Yanis was like. Cause like I said, I just feel like people don't know anything about that time. Some of my other favorite anecdotes were showing a more introspective, lonelier side of him once he got to the NBA. I think people were so enamored by how adorable Yanis was and how, you know, the internet just fell in love with him and loving the smoothies. People really didn't know that he was so lonely and so sad. And he was really just lost without his family because they couldn't get visas. And so, you know, the book really tackles like these moments of vulnerability where all these improbable things might not have happened. So I think like you do have the feel good parts and the inspiring story, but you also get like the real moments of adversity where he was challenged.
That's amazing.
I want to thank our sponsor, BetQL. If you want an edge over the sports books during the NBA playoffs, you need to download BetQL, the only app you'll need to make smart bets. Their best bet algorithm scans over 350,000 bets per year to give you the best bet recommendation for every game across all major sports. They also give you the reasoning behind why you should place the bet. BetQL also has tons of other tools like sharp data so you can see who the pros are backing, and line movement so you can jump on betting opportunities in real time. Plus, you can save all your picks in one place to track your success and winning streaks, as well as view your rank on their leaderboards. Head to the App Store or Google Play Store now to download BetQL. Enter the discount code BBNSTREAM at payment checkout for 25% off any of their subscription offerings. They also have some deals right now because the NBA playoffs are going on, but definitely enter that code BBNSTREAM for 25% off. Don't miss out on the chance to beat your sports book this summer.
You mentioned this is obviously your first book. We talked about kind of the process, but what advice would you give to someone that wants to write their first book? I've always wanted to write a book, but it is very overwhelming. It's hard to find the time. And, you know, like you mentioned, it's difficult to find the right topic too. What advice would you give to someone out there or to me?
Well, number one, you got a book in you and you got a fan in me. And so I believe in you.
Thank you.
I would say, don't think that you're not good enough. I think we all get in our way, our own way, including myself. And I spend so much time at bookstores. Like, that's one of my favorite things. And it's such a humbling experience to like go to a bookstore and see thousands of books. And you're thinking like, how could I do that? Like, how could I do that? But instead of saying that, look at all those books and say, I don't think all these authors were born with special powers. Like, you know, like, if they're up there, you can be up there. Look how many there are. Like, look how many curious, talented, smart people there are. And like, why can't you be on that shelf? So I think the first thing is just like mentally getting out of your own way. And then the second thing is be incredibly organized. I underestimated how much information is required to do a book. I have like a closet full of binders. And it gets really complicated, like your interviews, then articles you've read, what time periods, where, you know, outlining, like there's just so much information. It's so easy to get overwhelmed. And so I would say be organized. And then the second thing is shrink the assignment. So if you look at a book and you say, oh my God, like I have to write 120,000 words, you're going to freak out. But if you say I have to write essentially 15 different long forms, that's just easier to digest. That's like 15 articles, which is literally what it is. 15 chapters, 15 long forms. And so if you shrink the assignment, it's more doable.
Yeah, that's actually really good advice. Then it's, you know, something that, you know, is manageable and something that we've done before. So it's not as daunting, because that's the hard part. I think just like getting started and getting past how overwhelming it feels is the hard part. But that's great advice. So I'm very excited for this book. Everyone, make sure you read it. It's available for pre-order right now. It comes out August 10th, 2021. So definitely check that out. It's going to be fantastic. But I also want to talk about some of the people that you've profiled in the past. The last time you were on my podcast, we spoke about your award-winning coverage of LaMelo Ball. You spent 3 weeks with LaMelo in LaVar in Lithuania, and then 2 weeks with him in Australia the following year. Now he was just named the NBA's Rookie of the Year. What are your thoughts on how far LaMelo has come from when you first started covering him?
Well, First of all, the thing I keep coming back to is like, my God, how the narrative has changed. Do you remember how much people hated this kid?
That was my next question for you about how much the perception has shifted. It's wild.
It's wild. And it's just so, first of all, I thought it was weird at the time that so much hatred was coming towards this like actual child, because he was like 15, you know, 6/16 when it really took off. And like he had, you know, he told me there's never been a time in my life where I don't remember a camera in my face. So, you know, I've always had compassion for him because, and found his story fascinating, because I wonder what it is like to just grow up, you know, thinking you have to be this person and you're destined for this. And you have no idea why all these people want to take your picture and think you're special, but somehow you are thrust into this life and what happens next. So that's kind of what led me to it. But what's changed is that people thought he was this arrogant, you know, rude kid that was spoiled and lazy and can't lead a team. And now everyone is just praising him, you know, wow, the vision, the intelligence. And, The irony is he's always had the vision and he's always had the intelligence. Those things have been obvious in his game, even though he's always kind of like scratched heads, I guess, a bit with like decision making back when he would pull up at like half court. There was still always that vision there. And so I don't know. I think people like love to hate him and now love to love him. But like the eerie thing about LaMelo from like all my time around him is that I've always just noticed this confidence that he's had. It really wasn't arrogant. It was actually the opposite of arrogance, because people might not believe it because he does come off as really like this loud personality. He's like very shy and soft-spoken at times. And, but at the same time, he always like believed he could do it. And I think like not a lot of people did, but he always just had this like self-assurance, like, of course I'm going to like do this. Like, yeah, I think because basketball was the one place where he didn't have to perform. I know it sounds really weird, but what I mean by that is like perform in the sense of acting. And his whole life, he's been having to perform this reality show life he didn't really want to. And basketball was like refuge from that. Cause if you didn't have cameras, like reality show people, you didn't have to be an image. You could just play ball. And so I think like, that's why he's so natural in that space. That's why he's so comfortable.
That makes a lot of sense, because you have the reality show. You also have social media where everyone's kind of always performing, it feels like. But yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I remember when he went to Lithuania, because it was the unconventional path, his draft stock took a huge hit. Mock drafts were suddenly, you know, he was slipping big time down the mock drafts. People were sharing clips about, you know, him not playing any defense. And that was the big knock on him. It was, yeah, you know, pulling up from deep, no defense. He's basically just cherry picking. Like you heard all these different things, and it almost became, yeah, it became popular to kind of hate on LaMelo, and it became a big joke. I remember there'd be tons of clips of him just playing very little defense that would go viral. And people were almost like hate watching some of these clips. And then sure enough, he goes back, you know, flies back up mock drafts, ultimately goes number 3 overall. Now he's Rookie of the Year. It's been wild to see the roller coaster. I think a big part of it is because that the family's kind of polarizing. People were upset about LeVar. They were upset about the fact that he was doing his own thing and it was playing professionally overseas at such a young age. But when throughout your time with LaMelo, how did he kind of handle that, the shift in perception? Because it kept changing over and over again. You know, did he just kind of block that out and not care about it? Or what was he, you know, how was he handling that during the time?
Like, I know it's cliche when a lot of players say like, oh, I don't care what people think, but genuinely just really didn't, because there were so many other pressing things at hand. Like, his mom was really sick and the stroke was like really, really hard for him. And I think like his life changed so much that I think it was Jermaine Jackson, who's like his, you know, best friend slash manager, who was like, LaMelo goes through so much, he doesn't even have time to process things. And so when I think about outside noise and criticism, I just think that like his life was moving at such a rapid pace that he didn't even, he just, it's too overwhelming if you look at what people say. I do think, I will say there is a vulnerable side of him that that does read it and does see it and is a human being. And he knew he was so different than what people thought of him. Like, I'm thinking of that time we were in Jermaine's car in Australia, and this Forbes article comes out and it basically talks about him like he's an animal, and like, you know, his talking about like, you know, I don't remember what it said, but I just remember being in the car and Jermaine telling LaMelo this, and LaMelo was just like crestfallen, just, you know, he didn't even say anything, but I could tell it was just like so hurtful to see himself be talked about like that. And that's why I really liked covering LaMelo, because I think that people expected him to be able to deflect all criticism and be a complete adult and professional throughout his crazy life. But the reality is he was a child in a really weird situation, and anyone would have feelings when the internet is bashing you, because of things you can't control with your dad. And so I do think a part of him felt it, but he never let it, change him or get to him. Like, if you were around, like when he sees people, he's just like, hey, what's up? And he like hugs them. How you doing? Like, I just kind of like never saw him, his energy change, even though he knew people were talking about him.
That's one thing that stood out to me whenever he first joined the Hornets, where you saw like quotes from Gordon Hayward and Bismack Biyombo and a bunch of the veterans. And they were like, he's actually really nice. He's always happy. He's not entitled. Like, it almost felt like they were surprised, because everyone kind of had an opinion of who LaMelo was. And you see the journey he's been on, and people are thinking, oh, he's going to be this entitled kid, da, da, da. And then when they actually met him, and you heard the same thing about Lonzo, people saw who LaVar was. And then Lonzo comes in the NBA and everyone's like, yeah, he's super quiet, really friendly. They were kind of surprised seeing who his dad was. I think that's the same thing LaMelo went through.
All the brother, like everyone I've ever talked to about this family, they're like, the kids are so nice. The brothers are so nice. Like, it's almost like everyone is saying this as if like, I can't believe it. You know, one of the experiences that like really reinforced that to me was when we went to this restaurant in Australia, the Coffee Club, I think it was called, or the Coffee Exchange or something. And LaMelo's favorite restaurant there. He went there every day. He could just go there and sign autographs and live his life, but he got to know every single cook in the kitchen. He knew their names. He would always say, what's up? I mean, these are like random people in the kitchen. Like, first of all, how do you even get in the kitchen? I don't know how he gets in the kitchen. Number two, how do you just know all their names? Number three, how do you remember all their names? It was just so, that really changed. It was stuff like that, that was like, okay, I can see why people like playing with him, because he's somebody that will support you. Like, he's always been well-liked. It's just, the problem with LaMelo is that he was that first generation of internet cult hero. And what the problem with growing up on the internet is that you are fodder for vitriol, and whatever people want to project onto you, they're going to project onto you. And that was his whole experience on the internet.
Well said. I could totally agree with you. Back in 2019, you profiled Ja Morant, who's another young NBA star who's been thriving recently. You spoke to, again, his high school coaches, principal, his relatives, his former teammates. What were some of your biggest takeaways from that piece? And, you know, what do you think of his recent success?
Okay, looking back, I love that story because he was so nice. Okay, and I know you and I deal with a lot of players. Sometimes they're not that nice. They don't want to be there. Ja is like so nice. At the end of the interview, he was like, did you get everything you needed? Like, do you need any more time? I'm like, this boy is not in the NBA yet. Okay. Like he has no idea how this is about to go, but, you know, it's just like so sweet. Right. And, you know, I asked him about I don't remember what the shoes were, but he was wearing some like really flamboyant shoes. And I was asking him, and then he was like, you got to get some shoes. Like what's your deal with shoes? Like, I just so nice. Right. Just like such a like very bubbly person. But, my impressions of him also were just somebody confident. Like, I think everyone was trying to write this story that he just came out of nowhere. Inherent in a came out of nowhere framing is like, it's kind of insulting.
Yeah.
And I think he was like keenly aware that people thought he like came out of some farmland in this, you know, wherever, you know, he's from in South Carolina and stuff. And like, he knew who he was. He didn't come out of nowhere. Like this wasn't some like lucky, I mean, yes, it was lucky, for example, that the coach was scouting another player when they saw him. But in Ja's mind, it was like, I belong here. I'm supposed to be here. I can play at this level. And I chose this school. Like, I feel pride that I'm at this school. It didn't just like luckily happen. And now I'm on the brink of NBA stardom. Like, I worked for this. So I think he was like really keenly aware of this, like lucky, you know, the way people love to frame stories like that. And the other thing I noticed about him was how much joy he got out of like bringing his teammates together and being vocal. I got to go to a practice, which is so cool because, you know, they never let you in practice.
Yeah.
And he was like exactly the same as he is in the game. And sometimes practice is like zone out for stars like that. He was like, no, you need to go here. You need to go there. Oh, this is my fault. Da, da, da. Like, I mean, I was really surprised that he practices as hard as he plays. And so looking at his current success, like it really does not surprise me. But then it's weird because, you know, we like to create these narratives that, you know, so-and-so was destined or whatever, but sometimes it's just the right opportunity and the right system. And I feel like he has those things that he needs. And it's nice to see somebody in a, you know, I don't know, just finding comfort in like, I know who I am and I know what I can do. And I think he's always had that.
Yeah, that was my favorite part of the piece where you're saying, you know, he's wondering, why not me? I'm sitting here scoring 40 points. I'm getting all these assists, even if his teammates can't catch the ball always because, you know, they're middle schoolers and high schoolers. He's wondering, you know, why am I not getting attention? Especially when you're on an AAU team with Zion Williamson and Nick Claxton, these other guys that, you know, are getting a lot of attention. That's got to be frustrating. So I love that part of it where it's not framed as this overnight success story where he got lucky or, you know, he randomly got this Captain America super serum that changed him overnight. Right, it's right. A lot of hours put in and that kind of led to this, and his hard work was finally paying off and he was proving himself. So I love the way that you framed that. That was a great piece. Another great piece that I really enjoyed that you did was Andre Drummond. It broke down how he's kind of finding himself in LA. He wanted to be part of something bigger than himself and really prove he can be a winner. Now, obviously the Lakers season didn't end the way they wanted it to. It ended sooner than expected, but now he's going to be one of the top free agents this offseason. What did you learn about Drummond? And if you had to guess, you know, what do you think is going to happen this summer? Do you have any, I mean, based on kind of your conversation with him and the time you spent with him, do you think he will try to prioritize winning and being in a situation like that or best offer available? Like, well, I mean, what do you think is going to happen in free agency based on kind of what you've learned about him?
I mean, I think he wants to be there. He's like open to other things, obviously, but you know, minus the injuries, like it could have worked, you know.
Yeah.
I think like just so many things went wrong. But I know he was like truly happy there and he felt respected there. And that's not something that he's had in a very long time. So I think that will influence it. Like the quote that was in the piece about like, oh man, like these guys hang out together. Like they communicate. I thought that was like so heartbreaking that that's like a, oh my God. And that made me feel like, damn, like a 10-year veteran is like shook that guys actually like each other and talk to each other. So I would not downplay how much that means and how that will affect him going. I think like KCP, like they've played together. They really like each other. Like LeBron really supports him. And it's like, LeBron is kind of like, that's what he does, you know, to guys like Drummond. Like he can really help people like that and support them. And so if you have LeBron in your corner, like you know, that's huge. So I don't know what's going to happen. Obviously, I'm not a clairvoyant, you know, reporter, but I really do think that there's a lot there and things could have been different minus the injuries. But I think what I learned is how sensitive Andre is. I think a lot of our, I guess, sports media conversations have been over the last couple of years about like the dying big man and how, you know, that they've been phased out. And I just feel like every other day there's some comment about this. And, but I wanted to know, like, what is that like when you're one of those people being phased out? And like, isn't that painful? Like you've played your whole life one way and you've been enormously successful at it. And then all of a sudden you're not what's popular anymore. And you've been on really bad teams and now you're like facing basketball mortality. And I think like just seeing how hard that was for him, like his mom was like, it hurt like the holy hell. She said that to me. I don't know. I gained an appreciation for the struggles that he went through because I know it's not easy. And I also don't think people knew that he tried to change. I think that was the biggest thing is like, everyone's just like, oh, Andre, like he doesn't care. He's lazy. He doesn't work hard. He's not trying to adapt. He really did try to adapt. He spent the summer shooting threes. So I don't know. I would rather profile Andre Drummond than, you know, a superstar that has everything going for him, because I think it's more interesting to see how somebody responds when they're struggling.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think it says a lot about the destination or the, you know, the teams he was on, Detroit, Cleveland, teams that were typically younger and typically losing. But it's funny you mentioned him being shocked that the Lakers hung out and everything. I heard that from players in the bubble too. Like sometimes they don't, especially guys who've only been on one team, they know things only one way. And then they're in the bubble and they're seeing how other teams are interacting in the hotel. And they're like, wait a second, that might be normal. I might not be, this situation might not be what I thought it was. So I think that caused a lot of guys to kind of reevaluate some things. But yeah, I love the fact that you kind of talked about him trying to improve shooting threes. And then, yeah, the stuff about just him, you know, being teased as a kid for being super tall and lanky and, you know, parents yelling, get him off the court because he was growing into his body and not really good at basketball yet. I think a lot of that stuff, it explains why he is more sensitive and why he is the way he is today. So that was amazing. And then speaking of kind of explaining why someone is the way they are today, your article on Jayshon Tate was very sad, but also I thought it was an amazing look at, you know, how his childhood and his past trauma shaped him and who he is today. You know, he was one of the NBA's best stories this season. For people that don't know or who missed the article, I would highly recommend it. But his mother was murdered when he was very young and he started getting in trouble in school and like having a lot of issues. But, you know, it's amazing to see where he is now after, you know, what he went through as a kid and then also just his journey to this point. What were some of your biggest takeaways from the time you spent with Tate?
Yeah, no, thank you for that. I think, first of all, like, I don't know about you, but when I look at guys on the bench, I always ask myself, how many of these guys do you think like really loves the game of basketball still? I just always do. I'm so curious, you know, because so much shit has happened along the way where it becomes a business and you don't love it anymore. I look at Jayshon Tate even before profiling him and I was like, oh my God, this guy loves basketball so much. Like I can feel it. I can see it. The way he plays is just so, you know, passionate. And so I'm just like, what the hell happened to him to create that? Because that comes from something. That's a deep down thing that you can't teach. And so what I took away from him is that like, it's been a really long time since he's processed that trauma and it's always going to be there. But he is somebody that's like when he was left off the Rising Stars, he's like, yeah, so I didn't expect to be on there. Like he really doesn't approach life like he is going to be given anything. And again, I know cliche, that's what they all say, but like literally like Jayshon is like, no, the norm is being left off. The way that I'm going to operate, I'm just going to assume that they're going to leave me off. And so I just respect that so much, because he still doesn't think he's accomplished anything. Like he played so well and proved himself, especially being undersized. We were just talking about like the way the game has moved. He's like, oh, I haven't done anything. I think he said, I haven't done shit. I think that was the quote. So I actually love that about him. And then secondly, you know, imagine if every single time you're about to achieve something, something goes wrong. So he has like 5 surgeries. He only gets a shot overseas because some other guy's injured. The new GM is like, you're too short. He finally gets a summer league break and there's an earthquake. Like, imagine everything always going wrong, and yet you still have a glass half full mentality.
Yeah.
It's remarkable. It's to continue to have faith that things will happen for you, even though life has shown you that the worst can happen to you, is nothing short of miraculous, honestly. Cause I know I don't think like that at all.
Me neither. It makes me appreciate people that do. Cause I definitely would be just very negative and frustrated and blaming everything. So I'm with you there. So I have one last question for you, and it's more just on the media side about your own career. I feel like you have become one of the, if not the best, feature writers in the industry. And I feel like, you know, I'm sure agents and PR people are constantly reaching out to you. Like, will you profile my player? Does that happen all the time? Because before it was kind of Lee Jenkins, before he joined like the Clippers and left. I know even LeBron, when he signed with Cleveland again in free agency, he went to Lee and wanted that. You know, are you constantly hearing from players and agents and PR people about, you know, hey, will you please write about my player?
Okay. Again, you are like far too kind, and I just don't feel I don't feel worthy of any of it, but I'm deeply grateful for you saying that. Especially because Lee Jenkins is like my hero.
And he's amazing.
I just like fangirled so hard when I was at my first NBA like shoot around and he was there and he had a name tag that said Lee. And I was like, I know who you are.
he's the nicest guy too.
He's so nice. Oh my God. He's so nice. But, yes, people do reach out. But then there's a whole other side of things where it's like, I feel like I'm always trying to prove myself. And I don't know if that's just because that's who I am. But, you know, some of these agents, like, I'll just be honest, like, they don't care about having a story, but half of them do and do understand the value of like a deep human interest story. And so I've seen it both ways. Like, I am really touched when people reach out and say like, loved your story on so-and-so, like, I'd love for you to do something on this. Like, that just touches me because it's not really about me. It's about they understand the value of storytelling in a world that is so commodified. Mm-hmm. So I feel like honored with that. And even when they turn me down, you know, for them to say like, I appreciate your work. Sorry, it's just not, it's a pass here. That makes me feel good. But to be honest, I feel like I'm always jumping through hoops like, hey, just following up. Hey, just following up. Hey, it's me again. It's me. A lot of my stories happen because I don't give up on them. And they're really, really hard to get access to because I want the bigger stories. I want the more ambitious stories. You know, I actually was on that Andre story for like ever. And the day that he signed with LA, I just like reached out to his agent. I was like, I just want to remind you that I live in LA and I'm fully vaccinated, you know? So it's constantly just following up. And, you know, if somebody says no to me, I don't really register it as like, no. In my head, it's like, not right now. And I think operating like that has allowed me to just be really like persistent. And the good thing is that people know that I like to tackle sad stories too, because I don't want to just write about positive, like, you know, things. I think there's a tendency in sports media to just always do like the resilient comeback from whatever story. Sometimes shit is just really sad. Sometimes there's addiction and the person dies. And sometimes there's a tragedy and a girl dies. And I just am relieved that I have a portfolio now where I can say, hey, I've tackled similarly tough stories. Would you give me a chance to listen to yours? So,
yeah. And I think, like, I remember whenever your Andre Drummond piece dropped, the reaction was from people that were like, I thought one way about Drummond. Right. And now here, after reading this piece, everything makes much more sense, where I'm not so frustrated when he misses a layup. I legit saw tweets, people saying that it changed the way they think about him. So if you would think that agents would recognize that and be like, oh, we really need to get in front of this and reach out. But I was just curious about that. But I don't, it is credit to your persistence as well.
Well, agents, listen up. If you want a profile, you know where to find me. I would not do a hatchet job. And I just had to advertise myself there.
Yes, please do. But it has to be a good story, because you don't you don't have, you know, puff pieces and you only put out bangers these days. So it has to be a great story.
Thank you.
Well, I just want to say, keep up the great work. It's been awesome, you know, reading all your stuff. It's fantastic stuff. Everyone, make sure you check out her amazing work at The Ringer and go pre-order Giannis, The Improbable Rise of an NBA MVP. It's available for pre-order right now. And it's also going to be on bookshelves August 10th, 2021. Check that out. Thank you so much for your time. I can pick your brain for hours. Thank you for joining me.
Oh my gosh, dude, you're amazing. Thank you for having me. And I look forward to your book, whenever that is, being on my shelf. So I'm manifesting this right now.
Oh man, now I have to do it. Now I'm really nervous. Oh God. Well, I appreciate it. And if anyone wants to hear more episodes of this podcast, check us out every week. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, anywhere you listen to podcasts. And until next time, thanks for listening.